From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It was a busy day at UN headquarters in New York last Friday. First, there was this surprise announcement about the ongoing war in Syria.
What we've achieved today is to pass a resolution in the United Nations Security Council for the first time since this war started that embraces a roadmap for actually trying to end it.
The details of a framework agreement for a settlement of the Syrian conflict came out late Friday.
A roadmap to try to bring about a peaceful resolution through the political process, obviously.
In a press conference, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov took questions from the press after issuing statements.
For years now, country after country and at meeting after meeting, we have reinforced the notion that there's no military solution, there has to be a political solution. The only problem is the only thing playing out was the military track, and there was no political track. So now, finally, after two meetings in Vienna and the meeting here, and today's unanimous vote in the Security Council, there is a clear United Nations embraced, Security Council endorsed, a political track that reflects the hard work of the International Syria Support Group, which for the first time is a group that contains all of the parties engaged in support or in opposition to the Assad regime.
Dame gospoda.
Ladies and gentlemen, I should like to start by expressing my appreciation to John Kerry because it was his initiative to gather all of us here in New York. This initiative from the very beginning was not a guarantee of success, and yet we agreed that it was necessary first and foremost try to achieve unanimity within the framework of the ISSG. It is a very difficult group because it brings together countries that have diametrically opposed opinions to the Syrian crisis and to the ways to settling it, but that is also the strong suit of this group because only by engaging all the stakeholders that can influence the situation on the ground can we achieve a good result.
Political analyst Mark Sloboda, who's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University, laid out some of the details of the new agreement.
Some of the things the resolution notably calls for are it does recognize the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the Syrian Arab Republic. It calls for a unified, non-sectarian, secular Syria to come out of this. It does give a timeline for talks with the government between the so-called opposition and the government to begin within a month, a political transition within 6 months, and a free and fair elections within 18 months.
However, Sloboda pointed out that the framework was far from a final agreement.
Already, almost within the question and answer session with the press afterwards, Kerry and Lavrov were already disagreeing again on the fate of Syrian President Assad. Also on the composition of the terrorists, the ceasefire excludes specifically ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and all other groups associated with it, and other terrorist groups. This list, a complete list of terrorists, which supposedly Jordan is compiling, is certainly a ground for contention. Who would enforce a ceasefire? The UN peacekeepers certainly aren't going to be able to be sent to do this. So then that's the question of who will enforce the ceasefire. And then there's the fact that most of the fighting forces on the ground, what we refer to as anti-Assad rebels, most of it being Al-Qaeda, which is already excluded, Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam. None of them are going to agree to any of this because they don't agree with a democratic, non-sectarian, secular Syrian state. They want an Islamic state, just another Islamic state other than the Islamic state that's already been declared. So I don't see much hope for this. And in fact, immediately afterwards, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was already saying, I'm not optimistic about what we've just signed.
Immediately following its session on the war in Syria, the Security Council discussed a demand by the Iraqi government that Turkey remove its troops from Iraq. Baghdad said it had come to the UN only as a last resort after all other efforts seeking the removal of the Turkish military from its territory had failed. This was Iraq's permanent representative to the UN, Ibrahim al-Ja'afari, at Friday's session.
Amidst a severe sensitivity in the world as regarding the fight against the terrorist wave that hit most parts of the world on the 3rd of December 2015, Turkish forces, estimated at hundreds of soldiers with a number of armed vehicles, tanks and artillery, have penetrated into Iraqi territory to the depth of 110 kilometers into northern Iraqi, in particular without an official permission from the Iraqi federal authorities. So, this constitutes a serious violation of Iraqi sovereignty and the principles of international law relating to neighborly good relations, mutual respect, and non-interference in the internal affairs of the member states in consonance with Article 2 of the UN Charter. The arguments of the Turkish officials made to the media are unacceptable to Iraq, that they were trying to justify their violation against the borders of a sovereign neighboring state. Those military movements constitute a hostile act according to established international rules and norms. Iraq rejects any military movements in the area of counterterrorism without the knowledge of the Iraqi federal authorities and its approval. Iraq has spared no effort and exhausted all diplomatic channels and bilateral negotiations with Turkey in order to withdraw its forces that are unauthorized in Iraq. On 6 December 2015, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Iraq summoned the Turkish ambassador in Baghdad and presented him with an official protest demanding that the Turkish government has to clearly clarify in a statement the circumstances and backgrounds of the intrusion and the incursion of Turkish troops. Baghdad also received a delegation from Turkey and made it clear that the Turkish troops, which enter without consent and coordination with the Iraqi federal government, must be withdrawn. The Turkish delegation had agreed in principle to withdraw, but they asked for some time in order to declare that after their return to Ankara. We were surprised that they refused to withdraw those troops and this serious violation of the Iraqi sovereignty and security, which constitutes a flagrant violation of the principles of the UN Charter and the provisions of international law and the relevant Security Council resolutions. As Iraq is committed to the framework of international legitimacy represented by the Security Council, which has a unique responsibility in the maintenance of international peace and security, Iraq is requesting your August Council to assume its international legal responsibilities in consonance with the provisions of the UN Charter and to adopt a clear and explicit resolution that includes the following. First, condemnation of the Turkish occupation and the illegal incursion against the will of a founding member state of the United Nations, that is the state of Iraq, and in breach of the rules and provisions of the UN Charter and the norms of international law. Second, demand Turkey to withdraw its troops immediately, and that the Council should ensure with all available means and measures the immediate and unconditional withdrawal to the internationally recognized borders between the two countries and to ensure the non-recurrence of such unilateral actions which jeopardize international relations and exacerbate the sectarian and nationalist tensions in the region and expose regional and international security to significant risk. As we hand over the duty to protect Iraq its security, its unity and territorial integrity to your esteemed council, which is threatened in all its resolutions the Republic of Iraq retains, in accordance with Article 51, the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense according to the provisions of Article 51 of the UN Charter, if an armed attack against a member of the United Nations should take all necessary measures to end this hostile act, which is an affront to good neighborly relations and threatens international peace and security.
Spain's ruling People's Party won 120 seats in the national parliament, losing 63 seats and its absolute majority to a possible left-wing bloc, including the Socialist Party with 90 seats and the anti-austerity Podemos with 69 seats. Reports say that that possible deal is being negotiated, while the People's Party is also trying to form a coalition government. Economist Felix Morena de la Cova spoke with RT after the election and dissected the results.
People are fed up with the traditional political parties in Spain. They are very, very angry at the unending corruption. And also, they wanted to punish both major parties, and both have lost a huge amount of votes. The second thing that we're seeing is that in Spain, unlike in England, for example, where Cameron was reinforced in his second term, here the recovery has been so weak and so slow that there's still a lot of people feeling the economic crisis, and there's still a lot of people unhappy with the government's policies, and that's leading to radicalization. So in the case of France, that's leading to the Front National, and in the case of which has some more tradition in that country, and in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in many other countries, it's leading to left-wing parties like Podemos or Syriza.
Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras offered congratulations to Podemos on its strong showing and said the results show the depth of opposition to austerity in Spain. As we reported last week, opposition has been growing and showing up in the streets of Argentina against the newly elected right-wing president, Mauricio Macri. For more on this and other news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. People are in the streets in Argentina, and it's not getting much media, but there are massive demonstrations against Macri's decision to try to deregulate the media and playing with the currency and all of that.
And there won't be much coverage, will there?
Yeah,
because
right.
Macri is the golden boy of the United States and the U.S. government's NATO allies and the corporate elite in the United States. He's their boy.
Well, of course, also the deregulation of the media is going to be putting money in the pockets of and control and power in the hands of these very same people who are reporting.
Well, yeah, and the devaluation, the effective devaluation of the currency. I mean, under Cristina Kirchner, they had this system called the CEPO, which was a mechanism by means of which the Argentinian government kept control of the exchange rate of the Argentine peso against the dollar and other currencies too, but mainly against the dollar, of course. And so by dismantling that exchange rate control system, what Macri did was, I mean, it's just classic neoliberal nonsense, isn't it? Let's liberalize everything. Let's free up everything. Let's create this wonderful free market that, no, and that itself is a complete misnomer.
Of course.
No market can be free.
This is a free market that we happen to own. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. No market can be free if there are powerful players, very, very powerful players who have disproportionately more power than everybody else in the market.
Right.
You know, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. And to talk about a free market, there's never, ever anywhere in human history been a free market, because they're always dominated by the people who have most power.
So that
was his ideology, and apparently around half the Argentinian people were foolish enough to buy that and vote Macri into power with this 2% or whatever it was advantage that he had. over the candidate who was going to who committed to continuity to Christina Kirchner's government's policies. And so the result has been a kind of a 40 to 45, maybe more, percent devaluation of the peso against the dollar. And that obviously is going to dramatically increase the prices of basic goods everywhere. And among the other measures that Macri has announced is he's cutting the subsidies that helped low-income families cope with utility costs.
Yeah, it also cuts the price of their exports, too. I mean, if you're buying the exports in dollars, you need fewer dollars now to buy them. For example, beef, wine, all
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is that, the neoliberal idea is that, you know, by prioritizing the exports and favoring exports, that this is, integrating as closely as possible into global markets, that is going to be the salvation of everybody. But well, everybody can't export their way out of poverty.
Not only that, there's an interesting dynamic involved here in that the purchasing power in places like the United States that buys much of the exports of Argentina is down, it's flat, it hasn't increased. And so they're not going to sell more exports to people that are broke in the United States.
Well, yeah,
and
yeah.
China. And China, though, does have that extra money. And so they may end up doing more business with China than with the United States.
Well, who knows? We'll see. And that time, the whole Macri, and I think we mentioned the last time we spoke that James Petras wrote an article about Argentina about 3 weeks ago. And he was saying that Macri is going to very, very quickly enter into a very sharp political conflict with the majority of the Argentinian people whose interests are going to be very negatively affected by Macri's economic program.
Right. And I guess they're in the street already because they're already feeling it with the inflation.
Yeah. And also, if you remember, Don, one of the things that in the conversations that we had about Argentina that we constantly kind of came back to was that Macri is going to take Argentina backwards, back not necessarily to the days of the dictatorship, but to the days of, you know, very severe economic difficulties as a result of too closely following the dictates of the IMF, which is what happened under Carlos Menem. But also, now what we've seen is that Macri's government has a strong repressive streak because they have brought, he's encouraged prosecutors to bring an action against one of the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, the group that has been a key leader in building the Argentine human rights movement in such a way as to make it impossible to forget what happened during the Argentinian dictatorship. And of course, those groups are the sworn enemies of individuals, not they themselves, but Macri regards them. Macri and his elite support network regard the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo as their mortal enemies. Right. And they've actually brought a legal action against one of the Madres, who was calling for resistance to Macri's government.
But it seems insane for them to do that, because what they're doing is invoking the ghost of those, you know, former regimes at the front end instead of, I mean, if nothing else, you'd think you'd want to roll that out slowly so you don't build resistance. And
yeah,
you have
well,
people
he isn't. I think one of the things that we talked about a lot in previous conversations about Argentina is the way in which Macri is geared to conflict. He's geared up for conflict.
Yep.
He regards himself as a kind of crusader for the neoliberal faith, fighting against all the dragons and demons that have been left behind from the era of Néstor and Cristina Kirchner. That's how he views himself, in that melodramatic way.
Yep.
So he doesn't seem to have any kind of sense of north.
another like Erdogan type with delusions of grandeur.
Well, yeah, and I hadn't thought of that, but that may well be a very accurate description. This kind of messianic belief in the kind of the neoliberal faith that has to be imposed at any cost and chop off all the heads of the Kirchnerites, you know.
Well, you know, if you think about it, you've had, you know, these petty dictators throughout Latin America, thanks to the United States, of course. And however, their reach, no matter how ambitious they were, was always, you know, only to the borders of their own nations. You know, they might try to adjust those from time to time, but that was it. However, now with the integration of that region, and you know, they must look at Hugo Chavez and say, geez, you know, I could end up running the whole show down here. And so you're going to see some competition among some of those little petty dictators if they ever get installed, too.
Well, and let's see what happens in the case of Macri. But Macri is so closely allied to reactionary corporate financial interests, especially in the United States. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and of course, I mean, one of the things that we should mention about his devaluation policy, although he wouldn't call it that, is that it means that Argentina will inevitably end up becoming ever more greatly indebted to international capital, in particular U.S. capital.
Yeah, I heard somebody, I think it was Laureano Ponce on Telesur, it might be a clip I played on the news last week, but somebody said basically where he wants to take the country is back to like 1995, which led to, or earlier, with, you know, to the last time they imposed neoliberal economics on the country, which led to the crisis. He said we're going to end up right back where we were.
Yeah, I think we mentioned this last time, and Macri is a classic right winger in the mold of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And what Margaret Thatcher did was, she got to power on the backs of a deceitful electoral program, suggesting that she would bring more dynamism to the UK economy. And what she did was, in order to do that, she destroyed the UK economy, so that she was back to in the process destroyed the labor movement, and that brought her back to a point where anything, almost anything she did after that to stimulate the economy was bound to work.
That's what Reagan did, because, here too.
And essentially what she did was engage in a string of smaller or greater credit booms, and the most serious credit boom, the Nigel Lawson credit boom, that started in 1986. Nigel Lawson was their economy minister. Was that kind of propelled the United Kingdom economy into short-lived prosperity that promptly collapsed in the early 1990s, which is why the Conservative Party got rid of Thatcher. Right. And voted in John Major at the time.
That's right. Well, anyway, we had the same thing here, by the way, just very quickly, because what also happened with that was the metabolization of the assets of the middle class began in earnest at that time, when they started pledging their homes and their property in order to get the loans that they were using to continue their standard of living.
Right. Exactly. Thanks for clarifying that. And so what's the relevance of that to Argentina in 2015? Well, the relevance is that they're going to do exactly that. Right. That is what they're going to do. And that's, you know, we're beginning. It's so crazy that people learn nothing. And we know what these politicians like Macri do. We know what they do. Yeah. And they're able to convince people that they're going to do something different.
Well, they didn't have people in the street here like that in 1981, 1982, 1983, and I suspect that they didn't have labor out in the streets in force like they have already in Argentina. I mean, they're out in the street in Buenos Aires already.
Yeah, and that's why, that of course is why, going back to your opening remarks, that is why you won't read about it.
Right. What else is going on in the region?
So yeah, there's the situation in Brazil, isn't there?
Oh yeah, with
the current state of play of these spurious impeachment proceedings that have been conjured up by the Brazilian right wing in the lower house, where they have a better chance of getting away with that kind of maneuver. What's happened in Brazil is that over the last year, ever since when was the election? It was last year, wasn't it?
That's
the
right.
Election, 2014.
Yep.
Was it 2014?
Yes.
And in that election, Dilma Rousseff won by a fairly narrow margin against the right-wing candidate Aécio Neves. And of course, that was at that time there was that tragic air crash in which one of the other leading candidates died in that presidential election, and their place was taken by the so-called supposed ecologist Marina Silva, who then didn't do very well at all in the actual election. But ever since then, the right wing in Brazilian's parliament, backed up as usual by the mass media in Brazil that are very, very concentrated in the hands of sympathizers of the right-wing parties, they've been mounting a permanent campaign of destabilization against Dilma Rousseff, very similar to the campaign against Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, taking advantage of the decline in international commodity prices, taking advantage of the general decline in Latin America's economy. What they did earlier this year was they tried to pick up a couple of threads. One was the thread of corruption in Petrobras, the Brazilian state-owned oil company. Actually, that's not that also is a misnomer, because there's massive foreign financial interest in Petrobras. But the corruption in Petrobras is notorious and has been for years. And the opposition were trying to tie in Dilma Rousseff and Ignacio Lula da Silva, the previous progressive president in Brazil, to those allegations of corruption in Petrobras. And the other thread that they were trying to pick up was a more recent one, to do with the alleged mismanagement of the 2014 budget and an alleged manipulation of the 2014 budget by Dilma Rousseff and her government colleagues in order to present a better face in the 2014 presidential elections. And so those are the corruption allegations have fallen by the wayside. They couldn't prove a thing, because in particular Dilma Rousseff, but also Ignacio Lula Silva, they've been very careful about their public profile. And although some of their colleagues over the years may have been involved in some shape or form in the corruption that undoubtedly took place in the management of Petrobras over the previous 15, 20 years, they themselves are completely clean. And so what then remained to the Brazilian right wing to try and consolidate was this claim that Dilma and her colleagues manipulated the budget in order to do better in the 2014 election. And the person that's leading that charge is this character called Eduardo Cunha, who's the right-wing leader of the lower house in the Brazilian parliament. And he himself, as we've mentioned in previous programs, is somebody who has been demonstrated to have foreign bank accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere. And in Switzerland, his bank accounts have been frozen, even by the very, very tolerant Swiss banking authorities. So he himself is in an extremely vulnerable position. And the latest thing that has happened is that the Brazilian Supreme Court has said that the lower house in the Brazilian parliament does not have the power that it attributed it to itself to instigate impeachment proceedings against Dilma Rousseff. So that's a massive setback for Eduardo Cunha and his right-wing allies in Brazil.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.